My name's Bob Dono, an alcoholic. Welcome back. There's a saying in AA that three frogs sat on a log. Two of them made a decision to jump in the water. How many frogs are on the log?
Three,
because they only made a decision, right? If they did step six and seven, you'd hear the splash. And that takes us to page 76. Two very simple paragraphs for two very in-depth steps. There's a thing that's seems to be true in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're having a problem with a certain step, a lot of times it's not that step that's really the problem. It's usually a step before that. A lot of times people get stuck in being prepared to look at things an entirely different angle in step four because they haven't really made a legitimate decision in step three, or maybe they haven't really fully conceded to their innermost self that sober they can't manage their own life. They think they're right. And step six is really the crux of the matter. And you can't do step six and seven if you haven't done four and five out of the book, because they kind of they're just like a staircase. One builds off the other. And I think, in my experience, the story of the last 30 years of my sobriety has been the story of how I've become entirely ready in step six. My sponsor tells a story that I think is very good. He says that most of us come to AA, we're so beaten by the bottle that we throw the towel in. Our alcoholism's killing us. And then what happens is in a short time, we get just enough self-esteem to be dangerous. And we sneak the towel back. And we'll spend the rest of our life tearing little bits and pieces of it off and throwing it into the IRS, the judgments, the gambling, the pornography, the computer, the shopping, the credit card debt, the gratifying ourselves with this and that. And we just spend the rest of our sobriety throwing bits and pieces of it into the thing. How do we become entirely ready? Well, I think there's two ways. One is by pain and one is by inspiration. Unfortunately, pain is the more common motivator in Alcoholics Anonymous. More people grow from pain here than they do from inspiration, and which is kind of sad because inspiration is a lot more fun. But unfortunately, we hold on to stuff and we don't become entirely ready easily. And what seems to happen, and at least this was true for probably the first 15 or 17 years of my sobriety for sure. I hope to God it's changed a little bit in the last several years, is that I didn't surrender something, I wore it out. Until I've just wrung every bit of fun and self-gratification out of it. And the same thing has happened to it that happened with drinking. None of us get drinking when we're in the fun. We never get sober when the fun stage of drinking. Nobody does. I mean, and if you did, we'd try to run you out of here because we would hate to have you lose those couple fun years. I mean, it would be an abomination. Wouldn't it be the worst thing that could possibly happen is you get sober and find out you had three fun years left? I mean, that's terrible. Most of us get sober when we've wrung all the fun out of it and it's turned on us, and it's pretty pathetic. We get glimpses of ourselves the way other people see us, and it breaks our heart. It's embarrassing. And I think the same thing happens with a lot of our character defects. But why do I hold on to these things that cause me pain, that cause me jobs, that cause me relationships, that affect my very sense of myself? Because there's an illusion with every defect of character. In Bill's story, he does a thumbnail sketch of the 12 steps, and when he gets to step 6 and 7, He talks about them differently than anywhere else in AA literature. He says he asks God to remove these things, and he says root and branch, as if there's two parts. And there is. There is the thing that's causing me trouble, which you could say would be the consequences. But what is the value, the illusion of value? See, I want God to take the branch because it's poking me in the eye, but what's the root? Why do I keep doing this? What is it? What's the thing in me that secretly I think there's value in it? When I was a kid, when I was a little kid, there used to be a TV show on called Rescue 8. Some of you may have seen it. If you ever go to Universal Studios, they have a part of the sets in the studios, the firehouse where they filmed it, part of it. And it was a story, it was a regular TV show about these paramedics who worked out of a firehouse, and they'd go out and help people that were in trouble. And this one particular episode really stuck with me, and I was just a little kid when I saw it. These paramedics go out to this scene where this tiny little girl, cute little girl, is stuck with her arm wedged into a vending machine, and that she can't get it out, and she's crying, and she's hysterical, and the parents are there, and they're hysterical. And now, now the firemen are showing up, and they're pulling torches and saws off the truck to cut the door off, which is making the little girl even more frightened, and the parents more nuts. And it's just chaos. And the one paramedic's just standing there, and he's just looking at this little girl. And he finally says to her, he says, "Sweetheart, do you have something in your hand?" And she goes, "Uh-huh. What do you got in your hand?" "A candy bar. Would you let go of the candy?" "No, it's my candy bar. It's my candy bar. It's my candy bar. It's my candy bar. But if you don't let go of the candy bar, we can't get you. It's my candy bar." She will not let go of this candy bar. And he says to her, he says, "Sweetheart, if you will let go of that candy bar, I promise you that I will get you two candy bars." And only because she finally trusts him, she says, "Really?" And he says, "I promise." She lets go of the candy bar, and her arm slides out of the vending machine. What's your candy bar? There's a candy bar. Why do we hold on to stuff? Not because I'm self-destructive. There's some illusion of value or validation or security or self-gratification or something that I think is a good deal hidden in the defect. And Chamberlain used to say it was a process of uncovering, discovering, and then discarding. Because I think that I become entirely ready to have God remove something when I see that there's no value in it. When I at the end of my drinking, I was ready for Alcoholics Anonymous because I got it. This is a dead end street. But not a moment before. There's an old story about a guy who goes into the psychiatrist's office and he says to the psychiatrist, "Doc, you got to help me. I'm going crazy here. I don't know what to do." And he says, "What's the problem?" He says, "Well, my brother-in-law lives with me. My brother-in-law is insane. Doc, he thinks he's a chicken. Every morning when the sun comes up, he runs up and down the block naked, flapping, his arms clucking like a bird. The cops are over at my house all the time. The neighbors will have nothing to do with me. This is ruining my life. Please, Doc, help me out." And the psychiatrist says, "Well, that's not a problem here. Sign these committal papers. I'll put your brother-in-law in the state mental hospital. Your problems are over." He goes, "Oh, Doc, I don't know if I can live without the eggs." There's eggs. I bet you everyone in this room would like to be free of the sleeplessness when your head's going like a rotisserie from a resentment, and that horrible feeling when you see the person you resent where it feels like a cold wind is going through the pit of your stomach. Everybody wants to be free of that. But are you willing to give up the ego gratification of the judgment? The sense of being smugly superior. You can't be free of one without the other. I want God to take away the consequences of the resentment, but let me still have the resentment. everyone I've ever met would like to be free of that feeling, the hangover, the emotional hangover, and that sickness of your spirit when you've done something, when you've been on a self-will binge or a self-gratification binge, and maybe it did something in the sexual area that you really shouldn't have done. But your lust, or maybe your fear of being alone, or your insecurities drove you, and you went and did something that if you hadn't had this big vacancy inside you, you wouldn't have done. Everybody I know wants to be free of that hungover feeling afterwards. Do you know that inappropriate sex is like the exact opposite of going to Disneyland to ride Space Mountain on the 4th of July? If you go to Disneyland on the 4th of July, it's usually about 98 degrees, 98% humidity. You stand in line for 4 to 5 hours of hell with all these screaming kids for 30 seconds of excitement. Inappropriate sex gives you the 30 seconds up front, and then you feel like crap about yourself for just endless. Right? The insanity of alcoholism is that alcoholics often at times think 30 seconds of fun in exchange for 6 months of misery seem like a good deal to us sometimes. So, do I get it? Can I connect the dots? Can I connect the dots that certain things are connected to the way you feel afterwards? Right? I have a friend in AA who it sounds bizarre, but he used to go out with prostitutes. He'd pay huge amounts of money. And then every time he was done, he felt bad. He felt terrible about himself. And I asked him one time, I said, "So what's the price of feeling bad?" I said, "You're paying money to feel bad about yourself?" And he looks at me like, "What am I talking about?" I said, every time you do that, you get depressed and feel like crap. You're paying money to feel... I'll tell you what. Why don't you just give me $300 and I'll tell you what an idiot you are. You won't be in danger of catching nothing or nothing. Right. Can we connect the dots? Can you see that to do this equals that? There's a prayer in the sixth step. It's at the very bottom of the first paragraph. It says, if we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. Now, I don't know. When I was a little over 4 years sober, I finished the fifth step and I did six and seven and went on, wrote my eight step list. And I never saw that prayer. Now, I don't know objectively if I didn't see it because I didn't want to see it or I just didn't see it. But I never said that prayer. And I took a position for the next many years that was very, very painful. And the position was that I'm going to conquer my defects of character. And I don't think there's anything worse in AA than that. And I'll tell you, and if you do that for 5 or 10 years, you'll understand why the first word in the seventh step is humbly. Because you fail. And what would happen to me is I would become stronger in every defect that I fought with self-will. There's a principle in the universe for every action. There's an opposite and equal reaction. It was almost as if I gave the defects energy and power over me by fighting them. It's very much like a slingshot effect. Okay, I'm not going to ever do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm even superior to people who do that. I become the intolerant, reformed, whatever. And then what happens is lack of power is my dilemma. And I run out of power. And all of a sudden, I'm right in the middle. One of the defects that I really became so painfully aware of in my fourth and fifth step is how judgmental I was. I mean, my resentment list was so pathetic of all these little petty judgments that I had of people. And so I made up my mind I was not going to be judgmental. So here's what happened. I became the guy who was very judgmental of people who were judgmental. Right? Which makes me exactly like them. What I was doing was with willpower. I had a sponsee who, he was a good guy. I sponsored him for probably 14 years. And he would have told you for another 2.5 years after that I was his sponsor, but I wasn't. When he was 14 years sober, he had a defect that he had fought with self-will for 14 years. And he had a lot of willpower, I'll tell you. And he fought it with modicum of this success externally, except that he became the reform guy. And it was in the sexual arena. And it was something that to him was such, he felt so bad about and was such an abomination, he could not take it to God. It was almost as if I got to clean, in order to take this to God, I got to get cleaned up a little bit, right? As if he had to conquer the defect before he could take it to God, because he had such self-judgment on himself for being that way. Well, when he was 14 years sober, he found a site on the internet that catered to people like that, that were into this particular deal. And it was a bad deal. I mean, this is kind of stuff that can put you in prison. And every time he would act out on this, he would go into a deep depression. Well, some knucklehead doctor who was around AA that should have known better, who was not a psychiatrist, when he came to a meeting one day and said, you know, I'm really in this funk, depression, gave him antidepressants, which enabled him to continue the behavior. Well, about a year later, he calls me up. And he says, my doctor wants me to take, I thought I should call you. Now, he hasn't been calling me. He calls me once in a while just to tell me he's all right. He calls me up and he says, my doctor wants me to take sleeping pills. I said, sleeping pills? You can't, alcoholics can't do sleeping pills. I mean, if you're not sleeping, let's find out why. What's got you spinning in your head? What's got you anxious? What's got you, what's unresolved in you? Oh, no, it's nothing like that. This is a chemical reaction to the antidepressants. Now, I'm supposed to be the guy's sponsor. I said, you're on antidepressants. He said, yeah. I said, how come you never told me? Well, it's a brain chemistry thing. It's not, that's medical. None of your business. I said, well, okay. I said, look, I'm not a psychiatrist or doctor. I don't know about antidepressants. But, God, I've always thought and been told that alcoholics can't take sleeping pills. He said, no, it's a legitimate reason. Well, another little period of time went by, and he had a heart incident, ended up in the hospital. They had to do surgery on him. They gave him pain medicine. The pain medicine touched the sickness of his spirit and took off. Within 3 months, his brother gets me, and they have him strapped down in the intensive care unit. He'd been up to over 30 Lortabs a day, and he had all these doctors running, and they cross-checked that stuff, and they all cut him off on the same day. And his blood pressure went through the roof, and they thought he was going to have a stroke. And they put him in intensive care, and he's a mess. And I walk into the room, or into this thing where the bed is, the cubicle or whatever it is, with a curtain. And the minute I walk in, he starts crying. He says, this doesn't mean I got to change my sobriety date, does it? The ego never dies. It'll kill us, but it doesn't want to die. It doesn't care if it kills us, as long as it's intact. And I said to him, listen, we'll deal with that later. Well, after he got back on his feet, he refused to change his sobriety date. And he eventually got addicted again to drugs, and then he started drinking. And within a very short period of time, a guy who coached soccer, who worked out the gym 4 or 5 times a week, a guy that was in perfect health, he died. And as he's dying, everything's going wrong with him. And the doctors are astounded why everything's shutting down, everything just started going wrong with him. And I'll tell you what I believe. I can't prove it. There's a line in our book that says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I think the reverse is true. I think if I get sick in here with my spirit and myself, I think it is not unusual for me to start getting physically sick. ulcers, headaches, spastic colitis. All of a sudden, I am in conflict with myself. When my spirit's sick is when I start thinking weird stuff. I'm more defensive. I'm more paranoid. I'm more controlling. I get mentally and physically ill. I think what I watched in him over a couple-year period was almost like the reverse of the portrait of Dorian Gray. And within just a couple years, a guy who was a vital guy looked like an 80-year-old guy dying of cancer. It was the most unbelievable thing I'd ever seen. And I think it was all because he couldn't take step 6 and 7 with this one deal. There's no way I can prove that, but I just in here intuitively I watched that whole thing come down. I really sensed that was the deal. See, I can take anything to God. This idea, which is one of my old ideas, that I have to clean my act up first before I can go to God, is a deadly idea. Because lack of power is my dilemma. If I could overcome my defects of character by self-will, I would have done that years ago. I can't do it. And what are my defects of character? Aren't they kind of like defense mechanisms that I use to defend myself against a life that I'm afraid is going to be boring, vacant, insecure, and lonely? Why do I do these things? Because I'm in here. I ain't right. And so I grab on to certain things. Why do I judge people? Because on a spiritual bad hair day, I do it trying to pump me up. Right? I think if I pull you down enough, maybe I'll be better. What is lust except a defense against a life that I'm afraid is going to be boring, that's going to be lonely, that's going to be vacant? What is anger except a defense against the fear that you're going to walk over me or take advantage of me or get in my way or take something from me? All my defects of character are just defense mechanisms. The problem is they're defective. Alcoholics Anonymous would never even insinuate that I would give up anything that makes me happy, joyous, and free. AA is a funny place. In churches, you go to most churches and you're a sinner or you got certain, what we call, Bill in his story equates sins and defects when he goes through the steps. In most churches, if you're a sinner, they want you to join the church, but they kind of want you to quit sinning. I mean, it's sort of implied in the literature. I mean, you know, they want you to kind of straighten up your act. We don't do that in AA. Well, not at all. Well, matter of fact, we'll go to coffee and talk about somebody. We talk about in a loving spirit, loving tolerant spirit. We'll say, somebody, Ralph will say, do you know what so-and-so's do? Do it. And I'll say, yes. And one of us will say, yeah, I know. If he lives, he's going to help a lot of people. Right? Because what makes me useful? Accept the things, not my perfections, the things within me that are so helpful to the people I sponsor and some of the new people I work with are the things that have been wrong. The things where I've missed the mark, the mistakes I've made, the times I've fallen short. In the 7-step prayer, I'm reminded of the 3rd step where I'm asking God not to take away the things that stand in the way of me being happy, but to take away the things that stand in the way of my usefulness. And I'm being prepared to serve a purpose that we call primary in this lifestyle, this altruistic lifestyle of self-abandonment and service. And I'm asking God to take away the things that stand in the way of my usefulness. And God has taken some things from me that I'm not so sure I was done with. But he took them. No, they don't work anymore. You know how he takes stuff? Is you do it one day, it's fun. You do it 2 months later, and it makes you feel sick inside, and you can't do it anymore. Just when, you know, you think,
you know, it was fun there. Why did you have to pull the plug on that all of a sudden? And then he leaves stuff. I've had a couple defects of character that I've asked him to take away, and they stay there. Now, I don't know objectively if it's because he finds them useful or if I'm deluded about really being entirely ready. Maybe I'm still in the delusion that I think that I want him to take the whole thing root and branch, but I really just want the branch to go. I don't know. But from in here looking out, it often looks like I'm pretty ready about this one. And yet it seems to be reoccurring. Or at times it'll be covered by a thin veneer. And then on a spiritual bad hair day, it's like the veneer cracks and it rises up again. You know? And I think it always reminds me that I still live in the shadow of who and what I am. I've always, everything that God has removed sort of lingers around somewhere. He removed a compulsion to gamble within me that was brutal when I was a year and a half sober. I hit a tremendous bottom with it, became entirely ready. And then at about 25 years sober, with about $2 million, I got in the stock market. But it wasn't really gambling. This is investing in my retirement. Till about a couple years later, I'm insane on the computer 8 hours a day. I mean, trading stocks. I'm nuts. And it took me 6 months of prayer every day. And then one day I got up and I sold everything and I've never looked back. 6 months. Asking him every day. I'd be asking him as I'm trading stocks, you gotta take this away. Ralph, take me off the hook.
When ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of persons we had harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. And that's an interesting step. I don't know why it is that every time, you know, we have a discussion about the 8th and the 9th step, invariably somebody brings up, well, there's been this lingering, and when is so-and-so going to make their amends to me? And we do not have a step that says, waited for direct amends, you know, from those who, you know, that's not what this is about. Made direct amends to the, and contrary to popular belief, some people say, and I'm others. Bill Wilson had a pretty good grasp of the English language, and he did not say, except when to do so would injure me or others. I'm not others. And then here it says that we made this list when we took inventory. Sometimes when I've and that jumped out at me in later years, and I've started thinking maybe I'm somewhat deficient in doing inventory, because my inventory list does not include everybody on my resentment list. My inventory list does not include everybody on my amends list. But at any rate, I don't trip off of it too much, because I just make sure everybody's on my amends list, who belongs on my amends list. So I start looking in my inventory, and I start looking at people from that list, and that's my starting point. But there are many people who've shown up on my amends list who never showed up in my resentment inventory or my sex inventory. So I made a list of persons I'd harmed. And I do 3 lists, and that's me. Nowhere in the book does it say do it that way. A lot of times when Bob and I are sharing, some of it is experience that we share. I'm very careful to say when I'm sharing the way I do something as opposed to what's the black writing. It is what's the black writing, but it's a method I use because I'm going to put every name on the list. And I divide my list into 3, you know, the way I do it. It's the now list, it's the later list, and it's the never list. That way I don't reside with somebody floating around in my head that I say, I'm never going to make amends to them. No, I get everybody on paper. Now, later, and never. And that's how I divide the list for myself. And I start looking in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, has some useful suggestions, you know, and right at the bottom, a page says, what's an amends? Before we go any further, you know, I don't like to assume that we know what it means. We had a lot of hands of new friends when we asked for newcomers earlier today. What is an amends? Try to fix something. Reparation. Make right or wrong that you've done to others.
Be accountable for your side of the street.
I didn't hear you.
Being accountable for your side of the street.
Changing your behavior. So people are given different aspects of an amends. You know, an amends and an apology are somewhat different. An apology is, you know, an apology can be is a part of the amends, but it is not a complete amends. You know, so an apology can be part of an amends, but an apology can stand alone, you know, and an amends. So an apology is called for. I walk by Bob, I step on his shoes, I interrupt him when he's talking. Bob, I'm sorry I interrupted you. Keep it moving, I don't need to do anything else. By the same token, I didn't just step on his toes, I'm drinking my tea, I spill it on Bob's pants. I say, damn, Bob, I'm sorry I spilled this tea on your pants. That's the apology. How much is it going to cost for you to get it clean? Let me get your pants clean. I get his pants clean for him, I rectify, and I make right. I restore it with former condition. I make right or wrong. I try to make it whole. And to the extent possible, that's the aspect of amends that we get concerned with. Making right or wrong and restoring to its former condition when at all possible. I stole a TV, I replaced the TV. I stole some money, I replaced the money. I owe money, I replaced the money. I stole a ring, I try to find out the value of the ring if it's no longer in the pawn shop, and I repay it, you know. The reparation, the restitution, you know, and we'll go through some various pages, parts in the book that talks about how we make amends. First thing we see at the bottom of page 76 is some squiggly writing. Remember, when you see that word, remember, or reminding ourselves, you know, bad news follows. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning when you came up in here in that condition where you said, help me, I give up. I'm told I'm willing to do whatever it takes. Because ego rebuilds itself. Thank God the eighth and ninth step are where they are. Because now I've cleared away the debris that separates me from this power. I've now accessed some power. I'm now in a position where, because there are some conditions I need to meet before I can go about making amends. And we'll talk about some of the conditions I need to meet to make these amends. But it says, remember, it was agreed at the beginning I would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Right there, let's get ready. It's going to be some stuff that comes up that I'm not going to like. When you got to give me the reminder off the top, get ready for some bad news. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning that you said you were willing. Now for the bad news. You know, probably it's a misgivings. So at the purpose, top of page 77, it talks about the purpose of doing amends. And I might want to get right with the people that I'm that are mad at me or I'm not right with. Some of the times it's friends, it's coworkers, it's family members, and I really would like to be forgiven, and I really would like to get back in their good graces, and I might really like to get the friendship back, or I like to restore the family. Those are good motives, but that's not the real end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. Fit myself to be a maximum service. I'm estranged from the family. One of the family members did something to me that I cannot forgive. I haven't talked to, you know, somebody probably hasn't talked to their sister in years. Haven't talked to their mom in years. I'm not in a position to be a maximum service. Because one day, mom, sister, nephew, brother, who knows, may need some help. Just the kind of help that somebody like me can give. And because I'm not in the loop, I'm not in the family, when they go to ICU and they need somebody to show up down there. Or I'm not in the family when my nephew starts smoking or drinking and I'm uniquely qualified to know where treatment is. Because I'm not in position.
I'm not able to be a maximum service. So it talks about the, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service. Then it starts talking about some of the conditions for making amends. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. Middle of page 77. We go to him. Here are the conditions for making amends. Here are the conditions for making amends. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. If I still have the ill feeling, if I don't regret what went down, and all it suggests I probably haven't done what? Go back a little further. Probably haven't done an inventory on these people. If I still have not, if I can't go in a forgiving spirit, if I have not disregarded their side entirely, if I have not, then I probably don't meet the condition to make this amends. And check this out, I'm a person. I'm a human being. Sometimes the process of writing inventory still does not put me in the proper frame of mind to do a specific amends. There were some people who showed up on 3 or 4 of my inventories. Can't tell you why. Like Bob, maybe I deluded myself that I had seen all the truth about that condition. I can't tell you why. I just tell you who I am, and I tell you my own experience. There were some people who showed up 3 or 4 times on my inventories, and maybe the hurt ran too deep. Maybe I was shallow enough, and each year and each inventory I wrote, God revealed a little bit more. Maybe I got more thorough. Maybe I got more willing. Maybe I got more humble. Maybe I learned more about humility and fearlessness each time. But there are some conditions to meet. That's why in doing amends, it is very important, you know, to do each one specifically. Go over them with a sponsor. Because one of the things I find, if I lie to myself and I can't meet this first condition, if I can't go to them in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing my former ill feeling, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to sit up here and I'm going to say, you know what, Bob? You know, for the last few years, you know, I owe you some money and I really want to repay you. I'm going to make these payment arrangements. And you know, I really didn't intend to sleep with your sister. But and Bob is going to look at me and be like, yeah, man, that really was shit. Man, I didn't have to come to you in the first. Then next thing you know, I owe another amends. Next thing you know, I owe another amends. Because I don't know how that person's going to respond or react. When I make an amends to somebody, I got to be real prepared. And we'll talk about that on another page. I don't know how the person's going to respond. And if I'm still hair triggered, thinking I'm doing him a favor by going to him, I'm not ready to make that amends yet. So conditions for making amends, you know, first I have to go in a helpful and forgiving spirit. Under no condition do I criticize such a person. Under no condition do I criticize. I'm here to sweep off my side of the street, realizing nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until I do so. I never try to tell him what to do. That's at the top of page 78. His faults or are not discussed. The deal with doing amends, my experience, maybe outside of financial amends, if there are emotional amends that are involved, if there are personal amends where I had interaction with somebody close, almost always it's a two-way street. Almost always it's a two-way street. But when I'm making the amends, it's a one-way street. When I'm making the amends, it's a one-way street. So it is very important. If you wouldn't have said this to me, I wouldn't have done that. No. What about that money you owe me? No. Well, what about the time that you came over and Nope. What about what you did to me when we were over at my mom? Nope. His faults are not discuss. We stick to our own. 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happened. These are the things that might happen. 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happened. Sometimes he admits his own faults. That might happen. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. That might happen. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. That might happen. Sometimes they offer assistance. That might happen. Sometimes they throw us out of the office.
That might happen.
That might happen. We have made our demonstration. We've done our part. What about people I owe money? Most alcoholics owe money. We don't dodge our creditors. We tell them what we're trying to do. Skip down a couple of lines in that paragraph, arranging the best deal we can. We let these people know we're sorry. And financial amends found it very helpful to go with a good faith demonstration. Don't just go with an apology and an I'm sorry. Our man is sure to be more interested in a demonstration. On page 77, it goes back to this. But our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. Man, Bob, I owe you $200. As soon as I get a job, man, I really would like to come back. I'm in this spiritual program. Bob, I don't have a lot of money. And here's the deal with financial amends. Don't do like me. First time I set out to make amends, ego was still alive, and I had some problems with it. And good intention, I wasn't making a lot of money. I started making amends when I was about 15 months sober, and I wasn't making a lot of money. I didn't start working until I was 18 months sober. And I went to somebody, and I owed them some money. It sounded like a lot at the time. I wish that's all the money I owe right now. It was a few hundred dollars, man, but it sounded like so much. And I didn't have a lot of money. And I went to a person, and I was embarrassed with what I had to bring to them, and I was embarrassed with the terms I had to offer them. And I'm a guy that's interested in what I think you think about me, right? So even though I had done inventory, even though I was in the process of 6 and 7, that still was with me. So I made a deal. I made terms of a deal that I couldn't live up to. Here's $50. I'm going to pay you every 2 weeks $100 until this bill is paid. I defaulted on the deal the 2 weeks after the first payment was due. I defaulted on it. So now I owe a fresh amends. Because now I've lied to you about the amends I'm going to make behind owing you some money in the first place. So what's the lesson in that one? First thing, take a good faith. So some amends, when I have amends, it's a couple of aspects of amends. First, I might be ready. I might be willing, but I'm not ready. I'm not ready because I don't have a good faith demonstration. And sometimes I might be ready, but I'm not willing. I might have the ability to make the amend, but I'm not willing. I can't meet the other conditions. I cannot not concentrate on your faults. I'm not in fit spiritual condition to go to you, especially in a slippery situation. Some people in here might owe amends to an ex, might owe amends to an ex-spouse or an ex-mate, and some hurt is still there on both sides. You know, time heals emotional wounds, and that might be a slippery situation to go into. Some of you might have encounters where I could have it in my head. I could have it in my head. I swear when I talk to her, I'm going to be kind and loving. I hear that same voice, and we get to that same place, and she says that same button pusher every time, and I'm gone. I am gone so I've got to not lie to myself about it, even in that one. Take it to my sponsor. Make sure that I'm ready. So I'm making financial amends. I have a good faith demonstration. I do terms that I know I can live up to. Then I live up to them. What's the aspects of making an amends anyway? The first thing I do is I go and I say what it is that I know that I've done to hurt a person. You know, and I say to you, Bob, I know that these are the things. Well, I did an amends with my ex-wife. The very first amends I ever made, did it with my ex-wife. Again, like I said, I was about 14 or 15 months sober. Came over to my mom's house where I was living to pick up my daughter. I said, Mary, I need to talk to you. She's like, oh, okay. And I said, no, I really need a few minutes to talk to you. She said, that's all right. I really don't want to talk about it. I said, no. If I don't talk to you, I might go back to getting loaded. Oh, okay. You know, then she hurried up and sat down then, you know. And we sat down and we started talking. And I said to her, you know, I didn't talk about I'm an alcoholic. I'm trying to set my life in order. I mean, the wording is good and it's optional. She already knew that. And she was happy for me. And I said I wasn't the best husband I could be. I didn't bring my checks home from work every 2 weeks. I stayed out all night, and I stayed in. I was, you know, and I didn't say I was sleeping around women. I said I wasn't the best husband I could be, and I didn't do all the things that you should have expected from your husband. You know, I caused you so many sleepless nights. I've had guys come over to the house and threaten you. I took money out of the house. I took all the money. I emptied your bank account, and I went line by line. I had the car stolen, and I had cars repossessed, and I went through it and went through it and went through it. I didn't pay rent, all of the things that I knew I had done. And after I went through all of those things, I said, is there anything you need to tell me? And the floodgates opened. She went from I don't want to say anything to you to now having a forum. And we had been, you know, we had been hitting and missing. And you know how you kind of talk around and try to get away as quickly as possible when you're picking up or dropping off? Because things are okay, but you know if you stay too long, it's a powder keg, right? And so you're walking on eggshells around each other. And me and her had had many, many years of a successful relationship until I destroyed it, you know. But we walked around each other, and the floodgates opened. And the floodgates open, and she shared some stuff with me, some things I found helpful and useful in working with people since then. She said to me, you know, it feels to me, I'm happy for you, but it feels to me as if I got all of the bad parts of the relationship and somebody else is going to reap the benefits. I don't want you back, but it just feels like I took all the dirt and somebody else gets to get the benefits of it. And I don't want you to hurt, but I want you, but it feels like to me you're getting away scot-free. Feels like to me you're getting away scot-free. You know, and she said, and I feel bad for feeling that, but that's how I feel. And you don't know what it feels like to lay in the bed at night and wait on a phone call. You don't know what it feels like to just know when you get a knock on the door late at night that there's somebody coming to tell me where they found you. And she started sharing things with me. And she had an open forum. She had a forum that I opened up for. And I just listened. She shared some stuff with me that wasn't even true. I don't even know where it came from, but I just took it. I don't correct. I don't change it. It was some stuff that she probably missed that I missed. Man, I had a long history with her, and I don't change it. I just listen to it. Oh, no, that's me. I want to point out the one thing you got wrong. I just listen. I listen. And I said, I can't tell you. I can't put a monetary figure on how much money I cost you in that relationship. But I can tell you this. And my daughter was in private school then. And I was working temporary jobs. I didn't get a job for 18 months. And I said, I will pay half of her tuition. And as soon as I'm able to do better, I'll do better. You know, and in about 3 months, she was not able to pay her half of the tuition. And she asked me if I would. And I started paying. I paid that month, and from that month on, I continued to pay it. The next year, I bought her school clothes and continued to pay all the tuitions. In 2 years, my wife moved up to Sacramento. My ex-wife moved to Sacramento. I used to have my daughter in the summers, and my ex-wife would have her during school. We didn't want to change school. I started having her during school, and my ex-wife started having her during the summer. And I ended up raising that girl, and she's now, you know, and that's how that amends. You know, the other aspect of an amends, is there anything you need to say to me to make it right? And then the ongoing part of an amends of that nature is the living amends. You won't have to worry about this happening to you again. Although we're not married, you definitely don't have to worry about the aspects of a husband again, but the mental torture, the emotional blackmail, and the letting you down, you won't have to worry about that from me again. You know, and if I tell you I'll do something, I will. And I'll be a participating parent with our daughter. You know, and you'll be able to count on me and rely on me. And that's that aspect of that amends. You know, and it was powerful for me. And one of the things it let me know is if you have some problems, the residue of step four is in step nine. Some people always say to me, I still have this lingering resentment and I can't let it go. And if I still have one, I'll probably sweep the last pieces away. I probably owe that person an amends, even if I think they don't. A resentment, it seems like, wait a minute, resentment means I was mad at them. How do I end up owing them amends? Well, when we went to that fourth column, we did a lot of talking about that and found out most of the time, most of those people ended up on my amends list. Some of them did. Most of them did. Many of them did. What about creditors? Well, we talked about that, arranging the best deal we can. We must lose our fear of creditors, you know, and that's one of the things it talks about. You know, and when I look at this, it may not sound like it to you, but the reason I like the steps, they're integrated. They're an integrated way of life. And one will feed and take care of the other. Bob just talked about six and seven. And part of the activity is seven. See, self can't overcome self. And when you have, we might have some people who work in the car industry. And when a car is defective, they have recalls, right? On a lot of products, they have recalls. And when you have a recall, it goes back to the factory and to the manufacturer. You never saw a car work on itself. You never saw a car work on itself. When a car is defective, it goes back to the manufacturer. Same with me. Same with me. It's best to send the defect back to the manufacturer. And so I turn it over to that power. And then some stuff starts happening when I continue the activity of the other steps. Because when I start doing amends, the activity of the amends counteracts so many of my defects of character. And I'll come out the other side without, God will change me without my permission, but he does need my cooperation. And a lot of times he operates anonymously and I don't know what it is that he's doing. I don't know. It's kind of like Mr. Miyagi, wax on, wax off. I don't know that when I'm doing the ninth step, I'm doing the activity of six and seven. I don't know that's what I'm doing because I'm a lazy guy. But when I undertake these amends, I'm practicing perseverance. I'm practicing humility. I'm practicing persistence. I'm practicing forgiveness. I'm practicing responsibility. I'm practicing some integrity. Almost all of these counteract what it is that I'm doing. They counteract these defects, and I'm becoming something else. God won't leave a vacuum. He won't leave a vacuum. Bob said that before. So he's not, if I got a problem with life, well, if I do amends and tell you when I give you my word, you can count on it. That activity right there is the vacuum filler. God, if I got a problem with lying, he's not going to remove my tongue. Thank you, God. What he's going to do is give me the opportunity to tell the truth and risk looking bad or keep on lying and think I'm going to get something out of it. And I get to replace it. I get to replace it with its opposite. The activity of the ninth step, the action of the ninth step, the action of it, you know, right there. So these steps are integrated. If I do the action of the ninth step, I'll come out of that a new person. So many of my defects are going to be addressed. And just doing the action and making amends to folk. Making amends to people does. One of the things Bob has talked about more and more and more this weekend is judgments. My judgments. Do a ninth step. Impossible to do one of those the right way and not suspend all my judgments. I got to sit there and I got to listen. And I got to come out the other end a new person. Operating with some new sets of motives. Operating with a new attitude. You know, so that ninth step, you know, that ninth step, powerful step, you know, and it goes hand in hand with six and seven. Didn't used to look at it like that, but the more I started looking at the action and the activity of that night, I started realizing some of the side benefits of it. And I started realizing how closely affiliated it is with six and seven. You know, so just get busy with that. You know, perhaps I've committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. I got a sponsee right now, wrestling. I read to him from the book, and I give him my support. And it's a big decision for him. It's a worn out, and he's in California. But he's tired of not being able to go visit his kids. He's fairly young in recovery, and I share with him what's in here. You know, we may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink in anything. In my sponsorship, and I might be wrong, I take you to the water and I take you to the source and I take you to what I really believe. But what I really take you to is my experience. And I don't have the experience of walking in and looking at the judge and saying, I'm willing for you to take me. But I do have the experience of this. I do have the experience of trusting God with all it is that I have. And that's why I open up and I share what I have. I share about being broke. I share about going broke at 22 years sober. I share about getting divorced from 20 years at 22 years sober. I share about losing my house 3 or 4 months ago at 22 years sober. I share about losing everything materially that it feels like makes me who I am. And I share about walking with substance. And I share about walking with a sense of purpose. And I share about walking with a feeling useful. I share about that. I share about not missing a meal. And I share about not staying outside. And I share about the things that I've gotten in this fellowship and in this program that show me without a shadow of a doubt that it doesn't matter what's in front of me. There's a power behind me. I share about it. I share about that. You know, that's why we share the good, the bad, not because somebody in here, Bob already said it. That's the good news. That's the good news. There's a plan and there's a purpose for everybody sitting in here. And I don't have to feel like I'm qualified already. You know, there's a minister and he says it, and I'm not a minister quoting guy, but I just loved it so much because it fits. People think I'm not ready to sponsor. People think I'm not ready to do this work. People think I'm not ready to start working with people. And I heard this minister say, God don't call the qualified. He qualifies the call. And that just fits Alcoholics Anonymous. Ain't none of us in here qualified to sponsor. I'm a drunk. The hell am I qualified for you to put your life in my hands? What is that about? You know, if you heard this guy's story, he slept under a bridge and got the nerve to be sitting in here not waxing philosophical and people, and I trust him with my life. Where does that come from? How do I get to hear from there? And the good news, if you come from that place of uselessness, worthlessness, hopelessness, and having nothing and nothingness, if you feel like, what do I have to do to qualify? You already did it. Tear your life up. Just tear your life. Oh, I can do that. Keep making mistakes. Oh, I can do that. Keep having problems. Oh, I can do that. What? That's all it takes? Every single one of us is qualified. And that's how, that in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's how you expand your resume. You don't expand your resume by the service positions you get and the more stuff that you acquire. No, I just expanded my resume. Oops, got home, new, lost a house. Got that one now I get to share with somebody who's going to come along and lose a house. Oops, broke and recover. Got that one to share. Oops, coming back and recovering. So, see, because that's the valley side. That's the valley side. But see, when you do that part of the resume, there's some people in here that know, oh, he getting ready to have something else to put with the resume. He getting ready to have something else to put with the resume. He can really have something else. See, I'm already opening my arms. God has never, he hasn't dropped his boy yet. He didn't save me from that cesspool to let me drown in the bathtub. Every time I've taken what feels like a step backwards, every time I felt like what feels like a step backwards, God, you know, me, I don't know, what sounds like no to me, I just wait on it to play out all the way. And I find out that wasn't the real answer. He is either telling me, yes, not now, I got something better for you. Feel like no in the moment. I'm waiting for my something better. I'm just waiting for my something better. You know. So this activity of the ninth, you know, and so it talks about that. Chances are we have domestic troubles at the bottom of page 80. On page 81, it says, oh, and I know this doesn't apply to anybody in here. I'm just going to read these two lines right quick for your sponsees. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised, or men. Perhaps he's having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. Whatever the situation, some of you guys are laughing a little bit too much. Oh, you knew her too? The girl. Marty, at least she seemed like she. New friends, if you're sitting up here like, why did they bring these clowns in here? If you are not laughing in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not taking the program serious enough. You know, we have done enough crime. You know, we have a lot of fun up in here. You know, whatever the situation, we have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? We should admit our fault. She or he may insist on the detail. Who is he? Is it my brother? Or was it that guy next door? Or was it the mailman? I don't have the right to save my own skin at somebody else's expense. That's when we talk about except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, that's not important. Bob is...
He's, I was wondering, is she armed? So the hard minds want to know.
So it's something in there for everybody. I'm going to turn this over to Bob, but on the bottom of 82, the alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. Remember when we put flesh on the tornado when we read Bill's story? Remember when Bill roared his way through his in-laws' house? They lost the house. Father, I mean, one of them died. Wife and the mother, and the other in-law got sick. You know, tornado. And more than looking at Bill's story, remember your own? Remember your own? Some of you have to look at the babies that, Mom, don't go. You have to go again. See, I'm one of the ones that remember, I was a tornado. Bank account, empty. Guys coming to the house, threatening. Six of us, me and my brother, six of us living in my mother's house. Damn near gave her a nervous breakdown. If she didn't own her house free and clear, she would have been like Bill's story. Would have lost it. Understand this one. Long period of reconstruction ahead. You know,
I'm Bob, an alcoholic. How about if we push on for about 10 minutes and then quit for the evening?
Yeah, let's finish. Yeah, now.
Rather than take a break, we'll just do about 10 more minutes. I think it's very. I've been very fortunate to have good sponsorship ever since I got sober. My first sponsor was not real big on the. He didn't understand a lot about the fourth step, but he intuitively knew about amends, and he was very big on amends. I've always been in the hands of people that believed that you put yourself aside, that believed in the rule on page 74, is that the rule is we're to be hard on ourselves but always considerate of others. I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous in making amends, you never ruin it with an explanation or an excuse. You never talk about what they did. You stick to your own side of the street. There's... Amends at its very best is an action of other-centeredness. There's a line in working with others that also, I believe, applies to amends. It says we put ourselves in the place of the other person and approach them the way we would like to be approached if the tables were turned. Are you awake, hopefully awake enough by this time, or if you're not, at least maybe your sponsor is, to see how to approach... to see what it must have been like to be on the receiving end of what you're making amends for. And when you really get that, the words and actions become self-evident because essentially they're what could be done for you if you'd been hurt like that. There's a commonality here. I think that this is really where two things happen in the amends. One is, this is really where I clear away the things that have rendered me an unworthy receiver of God's grace and gifts. I've known men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous sober a lot of years that have had tremendous opportunities for abundance and all kinds of success. And no matter what they've accomplished, it pales. And they never enjoy it. Or they'll be the kind of person that acquires a lot of stuff and then somehow sabotages it unconsciously. Because I think that I think within me, if I've hurt a lot of people and I've never made it right, I know that somewhere inside of me. It's pretty hard to feel good about your new home when you bought it at money that you really owe your parents. Right? Or you owe somebody else. What do you do? Invite them over to dinner so they'll appreciate the nice home you bought on the money you owed them? How do you justify that? How do you feel good about that, right? And I I've had people that pushed me into amends. And when I was new, I was overwhelmed with the idea of amends. It just scared me. I lived on the streets for a lot of years like an animal. I robbed and ripped off a lot of people. I mean, not big scale stuff. I was never... There was a time I fancied myself a gangster until the police explained I was a public nuisance. This is pathetic. This is little pathetic, sleazy stuff. You know, if I'm at a bar and I run out of money, when you go to the bathroom, I'll steal your change and drink your drink. You know, or I'll steal your purse if you're a woman and you leave your purse somewhere. Or if you left your car unlocked and you got a stereo, I might break into your car and steal whatever's in there. Petty, petty stuff. And so I get sober and I'm overwhelmed at the prospect. You know, I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, if I'd have known I had to pay all this stuff back one day, I don't think I'd ever done most of that stuff. It was overwhelming. And my sponsor used to say, a way will be shown. He said that a lot. Keep coming back and a way will be shown. And I had a lot of problems with my parents. My parents loved me. I had good parents. They were not alcoholics. My family seems to skip every other generation. My parents, they pulled every political connection they could to get me in with the finest psychiatrists and the best treatment centers to keep me from going to prison on a couple occasions. They spent a fortune on me. And I'll tell you something, no matter how much someone loves you, you can eventually beat that out of them after a while. And by the time I got sober, my parents hadn't had anything to do with me in quite a while. They would not take my phone calls. I was not welcome in their house. They were able to cut me out of their life, but you know something? They could never cut me out of their heart. So my father slept 15 hours a day, and my mother saw a therapist and took medication. And I did that. And I knew it. I had stolen so much stuff from my dad that he became friends with the guy who owned the pawn shop in the town he lived in from buying his own crap back. Then when he became friends with the guy wouldn't take my stuff anymore. I'd embarrassed them. They lived alone pretty much, just the two of them. They had very few friends because I had such a bad reputation. My poor little sister, who I was her hero growing up, she used to get embarrassed going to school because the other kids would bring the newspaper articles about my arrest for possession of drugs and things and different things to school and show all the kids, and she'd be mortified. How do you make amends like that? And people in AA, and the money, I owed my father a fortune. The people in AA said, you just have to start making amends. And I wanted to explain it to him that, listen, it's too late. I'll never make that right. It's too late. And I am delighted that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous never gave a lot of credence to my opinions. They just said, well, that's fine. You feel like, just do this anyway. And the first direction they gave me, they told me to call my mother every week and don't call collect. Now, that would have never occurred to me. I remember I had some sort of bizarre sense of entitlement. You always called collect because I have nothing and they have something and mm-hmm. they owe me or something, right? I remember the first time I called my mother and I paid for the call. She answered the phone. She was not, when she heard my voice, she was not happy. What do you want? Then she goes, where are you? You're not in Pennsylvania again. I said, no, Mom, I'm in Nevada. You're in Nevada? Well, the operator didn't ask me to pay for the call. I said, no, Mom, I paid for the call. Her voice jumped a whole octave. She went, you paid for the call? She couldn't believe it. It was like somebody hit her with a cow prodder. You paid for the call? She couldn't believe it. They told me to start sending her little notes and call her every week, never to forget. A Mother's Day, a Father's Day, a birthday, an anniversary, Christmas. And I wasn't making much money, but I'd get them some little thing and send it off. And a year went by. And they're not accepting me back into the fold, I'm telling you. At a year sober, a year of calling them every week and sending them cards and all kinds of stuff, they still have this attitude that I'm probably phony and conning them. Because I had done, one of the worst things I did to my parents is I would get back, I would seemingly get back on my feet, get straightened out, I'd get their hopes up, and then trash them one more time. And that is a brutal emotional beating to someone who loves you, to get their hopes up and squash them, and get them up and squash them. Makes you crazy. So they were. I was a year sober, and my parents decided they were going to fly out to Nevada and eyeball me. Because they didn't. They were skeptical. They didn't think. And they came out to Nevada with this attitude, you know, he's probably a bum, but we've never been to Las Vegas, so it won't be a complete loss. That's honest to God, that's how their attitude of coming out. And I met him at the plane, and I took him out to dinner with my sponsor and his wife, and I took him to my home group, and they got to see me with you. And what it was my sponsor's idea to take him to my home. I would have never thought to take him. Felt weird to me to take him. But they saw me with you, and they could have never seen me better than when I'm with you. In my first home group, we had a tremendous amount of camaraderie there. We had a whole bunch of old-timers that would always pick on the newer guys, you know, and laugh at our expense and goof on us all the time. And then they saw me with the guys I was ran. I was run with a bunch of guys who were all sober about the same time, and we would take the meetings into the care unit and to the reality house, and we'd go out to the jail and to the state prison. We did all that together. We ran in a pack. And they saw me with the guys that I ran with. And then they saw me with a couple of the newer guys I was trying to help and how I was picking on them and goofing on them. Because AA functions on the first rule of plumbing, crap runs downhill. And they saw the camaraderie. And my parents, they wanted to go every night to a meeting with me. They didn't understand AA, but they liked it. They thought that the people were funny and very heartfelt and genuine. I remember one time watching my mother across the room. Somebody's talking about finally getting their kids back, and my mom was. She started crying. She grabbed my dad's hand and said, "This is wonderful. This is wonderful." The day before they left to go back to Pennsylvania, they were staying at the Stardust, and I met them for lunch at the coffee shop. And as instructed, I had my sheet of paper with all the money I owed my father. It was a lot of money. And I'm making a minimum wage, you know. I'm making very, very little money. And I had a game plan of making payments to them. I was told you don't wait till you hit the lottery to pay this stuff back. You sold your integrity a nickel and a dime at a time, and you buy it back a nickel and a dime at a time. And I had my plan. It was 12 and a half years of payments to my father to make this right. 12 and a half years is a long time. But I was willing to do it. And I sat down and I explained to him what I did. I told him the amount. I told him everything I figured. My dad said, "It's probably right." And I said, "I'm going to start making these payments." And he said to me, he said, "Rob, we don't want you to pay back the money." He said, "This is the first time in years we had any hope that you were going to be all right. We don't understand the AA, but we just want you to keep going. You're doing really well. Just stay sober and forget about the debt." Well, man, I've just hit the recovery lottery, man. I just got out of 12 and a half years of payments. Man, I'm thinking, I like this immense stuff, man. I thought, this is cool. I left the coffee shop. I'm on my way over to my sponsor's office to tell him the good news, thinking about other people I owe money to. I wonder if I get them to see the light like my parents. I get to my sponsor's office, and I tell him, I'm excited. I'm on cloud nine. This is great. I tell him the good news, and he looks at me and he says, "It doesn't matter what your father said. It's your debt, it's your integrity, it's your recovery, it's your spirit. You have to make it right." I tell you, sometimes you just know you got the wrong sponsor. And I said to him, "Well, what am I going to do if I send him this little check every month? He doesn't really, he's well off, I mean, he's fine, he doesn't need the money, he won't cash it." And he had this, he always said this, he says, "I don't know, but a way will be shown." Yeah, right. Well, I worked as a cashier in a store. My dad had one hobby. He collected silver coins, gold certificates, silver certificates, wheat pennies, war nickels. He was into it. He had bags and boxes of that stuff and books, and he'd sit for hours and catalog it all, put it in little groups and puts it in books and stuff. He was really into it. It was like almost an obsession with him. He'd just sit for hours with that stuff. And I'm working at running a cash register. It's in the late 70s, and there's still a lot of silver coins and silver certificates and even gold certificates in circulation. And every day they're coming through that register. And so I think God works through our sense sometimes. And I had this idea. I thought, well, maybe I'll talk to my boss, ask him if I can buy this stuff out of the register. Never, not with any plan to clear the debt. I mean, that'd be too much. That's impossible. But maybe I could buy enough stuff out of the register over a period of time that I could give my dad a nice gift. It'd be a nice gesture. And I talked to my boss. He said, yeah, I don't care, kid. I don't collect that stuff. He says, go ahead. And I started doing it. And there's a funny thing that happens with those of us that become willing to go to any lengths. And as you start moving down the road towards making things right, the universe starts moving the road down towards you. And it's a very serendipitous thing. And I started getting lucky. From the moment I started making that amends and some others, I started getting financially lucky. I started getting raises, bonuses. There was a guy in AA, there was a friend of mine, had a moving truck. He used to pay me $100 cash under the table just for a couple hours work helping him move furniture. I got a management position after a while running a retail store, started making some pretty significant money. And what would have taken me 12 and a half years, I accumulated the whole debt at face value in gold certificates, silver certificates, bags of silver quarters, halves, dimes, in about a little less than 5 years. And I was able to take all that stuff back to Pennsylvania, and I had a couple boxes of stuff, and give it to my dad. And my dad, I knew he'd take it. I mean, he could no longer give that back than a crack addict could give back an eight ball. I mean, he's gonna, right? And I want you to know something. There was absolutely no doubt that prior to giving him that money that he'd forgiven me and that he loved me. No doubt. But something changed when I paid him back that money. For the first time in my life, my father started to respect me. He loved me, but I was Bob. You know Bob. You got to make allowances for Bob. I was Bob on the recovery special bus, Bob. You know, I was, right? You know what I mean? You know how your parents look at you like, do you ever be around your parents and when they see you, they sigh, they go, right? And my dad started respecting me. And I think somewhere inside myself, I gained a little bigger piece of how I feel about myself started to come back. When I was a little kid, I liked me. I liked life. I ruined that over the years until I couldn't stand me and I couldn't stand life. And I think we mend the separation that we have with ourselves in addition to the separation we have with other people through step 8 and 9 and also through step 12 in helping God's kids. There's a lot of areas where step 9 and step 12 blend together, I'll tell you. Where, you know, there's people in AA that have opinions about you don't make living amends and stuff. Well, I'll tell you something. You hurt somebody and break their heart for a lot of years. The book says there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. And Chamberlain used to stand at the podium and rub his hands together, and he'd cackle with that laugh is and say, you rub away the wreckage of your past with good works. You rub it away. And sometimes step 12 and step 9 seem like the same thing. Because it's all altruistic acts. It's all making things right. It's all restoring balance in the universe. On page 127, there's a statement of cause and effect. I think it's a promise. And I'll talk about this and then we'll shut her down. And don't misinterpret what it says here. Right smack in the middle of the page, it says, although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found we could not place money first. For us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded it. I know guys in AA that make seven figures a year that have no material well-being. They live in a state of angst and anxiety over money and the markets and all kinds of stuff. I know guys that make very, very little amounts of money per year that have tremendous well-being. Why? Because they are one with the people around them, and they're one with God, and there's no anxiety and there's about money with them, because they know that they're going to be taken care of. They know God's going to take care of them. Where I've watched Ralph for the last almost a year go through a lot of setbacks that are tied to the economy and the different things, and never once did I ever seen him afraid that he's going to be destitute. He's always known, as I've in times of distress in my own sobriety, financial distress and setbacks, where I knew that it's going to be okay. I have a sense of material well-being. And it's independent. It has nothing to do. The great illusion is that you make enough money and then you have material well-being. That's not true. Matter of fact, there's alcoholics on a regular basis that blow their own brains out with $10 million in the bank and living in $5 million homes with no material well-being, no well-being whatsoever. Material well-being comes when my spirit is integrated and one with the material world. And to do that, it's really a process of facing everything I was afraid to face. You know, I think trust, the mechanism of trust, is often like a muscle. If you want to strengthen it, you have to exercise it and use it. And it is in step nine. Step nine is frightening. I mean, I'm paying back people at times, and I got financial insecurity in my early days of sobriety, and I'm paying these back. I whined to my sponsor one time. I said, you know, I'm paying all this money. These people have more. They're big. Some of these are big companies. They don't need this little bit of money. How come I have to pay all this stuff? I don't have anything left. You know, the big cry of the alcoholic. Yeah, but what about me? What about me? Right? And he said, he got tired of me whining one day. And he said, listen, you know something? They don't want your money. Whew. Good. He said, no, they just want their money back. And then, I think that one of the greatest things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is face all the people. And I got to tell you something. There's a big difference between making all your amends that's possible and making all of them but one. It's like a stone in your shoe. I have amends that I haven't made, not because I wouldn't, because I can't find the people. And they're always on the horizon for me. I think about those amends and wonder about those people on a regular basis. But I am comfortable in the knowledge that if I could find those people, I would make amends to them. I would not hesitate. Want to close?
We will see you.
We'll see you in 24 hours and 2 minutes. No, 12. 12, yeah. 24. Well, the guys that come in 24 hours will know a loneliness such as few do.